Fancy a new routine for 2024? Why not wake up with BBC Radio 3? Ditch the abrasive alarm clock and start your morning like this.
Breakfast with Petroc Trelawney.
Weekday mornings from 6:30. Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's midday, time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Merlin Sheldrake is a biologist and writer with a mission to make us look at and understand fungi. While we're familiar with mushrooms, truffles, toadstools, there are millions of varieties of fungi all around us, in the soil, in our bodies, in the very air we breathe, and only 6% of them have been identified. Merlin's wonderful book, Entangled Life, How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Futures, was an international bestseller. It caught the eye of the Icelandic singer and musician Björk, who recently released an IMAX film with Merlin, which she narrates. It's called Fungi, The Web of Life, and it follows Merlin to Tasmania on a quest to find an incredibly precious blue mushroom. Merlin, well, we're going to hear works by Chopin, Talis, Purcell, but first Bach, and I suppose of all of these composers, he's the most that has kind of fungal convolutions in the way he works out music, or is that going too far?
I don't think that's going too far at all.
Why did you choose this?
I've grown up hearing Bach a lot. My father plays the piano, and from a very early age, I would hear him playing. I hear the Bach coming through the floor of the house. It would be playing when I came home from school. My mother would be listening to recordings of Bach when we came back from various adventures outside. And so it's deeply part of the way that I hear and understand sound somehow. I don't know exactly how, but whenever I hear Bach's compositions and his masterful explorations, I feel somehow rooted. And this piece is one that just speaks to me particularly strongly. And in the last few years, I've listened to a lot. It's a kind of medicinal track for me. The brooding atmosphere, the sense of a momentum, and despite the tensions and intensity and darkness, there are moments where it breaks into a major key and light comes shining through the clouds that Bach's worked so hard to build before it returns to the brooding. And I just find that drama and that pacing just so powerful.
Well, the tale you're talking about is, of course, the St. Matthew Passion by Bach, and we're going to hear Come, You Daughters, Help Me to Lament.
Thank you.
wonderfully, as you say, inexorable feeling of moving forward.
Yes, it feels like almost like a slow whirlpool that once you get in, there's very little chance that you'll get out. But of course, you do get out. You're spat out at the end, feeling renewed. At least I feel renewed.
Come, you daughters, help me to lament, from the St. Matthew Passion, performed by the Academy of Ancient Music and the choir of King's College, Cambridge, conducted by the late and much missed Stephen Cleabury. Is there something in the way he uses and interleaves music that reminds you of your world and how fungi, for example, always growing but exploring new things, new territory?
Very much so. And this is a theme with some of these other tracks that we're here today, that of polyphony. And Bach's a master of polyphony. And polyphony, of course, just means having more than one voice and more than one tune going on at the same time. And each of these melodies would make sense by itself, but together they form something else. Together they form a larger whole. And I find that this is very helpful for thinking about fungi. Most fungi live most of their lives as networks, branching, fusing networks called mycelial networks. And these are strange life forms that really challenge our imaginations and are hard to make sense of. But polyphonic music really helps me to understand them, because you can think of each of the growing tips of a fungal network as a voice within a polyphonic piece of music. And each of them is sort of on their own journey, but together they're forming this larger interweaved whole that can do something that none of the growing tips alone can do. And so I found that listening to polyphonic music really does help me to think about life as a fungus in a different kind of way.
Well, we'll come back to that, because it's such a fascinating subject. But first of all, let's hear a little bit about your early life. You grew up in North London, and I think you were encouraged to spend time outdoors.
Yes, my father's a biologist and a keen student of the living world, and would take me and my brother outside all the time. We lived just near Hampstead Heath, and much of our time was spent running around there, exploring, asking questions, getting filthily covered with mud, climbing trees and so forth.
And your mother, a voice teacher?
Yes, so she works with the voice and the power of the voice to change the way that we think and feel and imagine, and to connect us with ourselves and with the world around us. So there was a lot of sound and music around growing up.
And your brother, Cosmo, is a musician.
Yes, Cosmo is a musician and a field recordist and a producer and a composer, and lives utterly immersed in music and sound.
What instruments, if any, did you play?
I play the piano and the accordion. I got really frustrated at all my friends who played portable instruments. So I thought that the piano accordion might be a way to find a more portable version of the piano, but it turned out to be such a different beast and not at all percussive. No, it's breathing. It's breathing on your chest. And I fell in love with it for so many reasons. But one of the things is that it's so social. You know, you can't actually see what your fingers are doing, so you have to play blind, which means your face is free to engage with other musicians.
The next piece does relate to your childhood.
It's a Chopin waltz, and I grew up playing the piano, and I loved playing Chopin. And I didn't actually play this waltz, but this waltz for me really sums up so much of the lightness and elegance of touch that Chopin writes for this wonderful instrument. And so many of these melodies he finds feel like they're hiding in, you know, right in front of you, but you've never spotted them. And he reveals these melodies which seem so clear, but which have eluded you for so long.
Thank you. A Nocturne by Chopin, the Nocturne in G major, performed by Nelson Freire. Merlin, what first drew you into the world of fungi?
I think probably the very first memory I have of being curious about these life forms was as a child spending time outside, whether carrying buckets of kitchen waste from the kitchen into the compost heap and then several months later shoveling what had become soil onto the flower beds, or lying in piles of fallen leaves which would slowly shrink over time as they decomposed. I became curious about how piles of orange peels and banana skins could turn into soil. And how is this possible? It seemed like a radical transformation. And I asked my father, who explained that this was done because of the actions of decomposing organisms like fungi. And through their powers, matter could change from one form into another. And this struck me as a superpower at the time. And really, it still strikes me as a superpower that some organisms have the power to underwrite these powerful transformations that lie at the bottom of the great chemical cycles that make up the kind of circulatory systems of the biosphere in which we are completely immersed. And so I was amazed at this ability and amazed that the organisms who could do this were so difficult for me to see, you know, that I couldn't just see them doing their thing. So that was something that led me into a kind of sliding helter-skelter of curiosity.
And your dad concocted an experiment, didn't he, to help you understand?
Yes, so the idea of decomposition was something he explained actually in terms of music. He said, well, you know, composers make pieces of music and decomposers unmake pieces of life. Without decomposers unmaking pieces of life, there'd be nothing for the composers of life to compose with. And so an experiment that he suggested we do to illustrate this point, and we got a clear plastic water bottle and cut off the top and then put layers of soil and sand and leaves going up to the top. And then we unleashed some earthworms in the bottle. And over a few days, you could see how they stirred and mixed all these layers into each other. And he said, look, this is kind of what I mean. These worms are mixing and stirring and remaking the stuff that's in this bottle and changing its arrangement and identity. And just like that, outside there are creatures like worms, tiny worms, and even smaller than tiny worms, and creatures that aren't worms but do something analogous. And it's really stuck with me.
Tell us a little bit about the constitution of fungi, because mushrooms are just the reproductive fruit, aren't they?
Yeah, so mushrooms are just the place where fungi produce spores, which are analogous, loosely analogous, to plant seeds or plant pollen. But most fungi don't make mushrooms full stop. And even the ones that do only produce them for a few weeks a year on the whole. So most fungi live as mycelial networks, and these networks are how fungi feed. So fungi find food in the world, as animals do. But rather than putting that food inside their bodies like we do, they put their bodies inside their food. And these mycelial networks are a really effective way to do that. They burrow and digest and insinuate themselves into whatever they happen to be eating, whether it's from the kerosene in the fuel tank of an aircraft or a block of wood or moldy bread, the bread that is being eaten by the mold, which is a fungus, in your kitchen.
In just a teaspoon of healthy soil, there's a huge number of fungi, isn't there?
Yes, so in a teaspoon of healthy soil, you might find anywhere from 100 metres to 10 kilometres of fungal network.
Absolutely extraordinary. It's not a centralised sort of processing the way fungi organise themselves, is it?
No, in a given fungal network, and one of these networks, by the way, could be sprawled over tens of metres, connected to the roots of handful of plants with whom the fungus is trading nutrients. This is a feat of coordination that is able to do all of this, integrating data streams from temperature to pressure to any number of chemicals, acidity. And it's able to do all of this without a brain. There's no one place where it integrates all of these data streams and coordinates its behavior. And this is confusing for us as humans because we have brains that we're proud of, and rightfully so, and where a lot of coordination happens, a lot of integration happens. And so when we look at a fungal network, it's accomplishing all of these feats, and its coordination is somehow everywhere at once and nowhere in particular.
And is it true that plants would probably not have become established on the planet without fungi?
That's right. So the algal ancestors of plants, as they started to move onto dry land about 500 million years ago, were faced with all sorts of challenges. You know, they're no longer floating in a nutrient soup like they'd used to. And they had to find their nutrients in water, in these young soils. And that's a very different kind of challenge. And what they did was strike up relationship with fungi, with their curious, exploratory, chemically ingenious networks. And these fungi behaved as the root systems of these early plants for tens of millions of years until plants could evolve their own roots. So these relationships with plants really lie at the base of much of recognisable life on land.
And it's tracing this symbiosis over the millennia that's really fascinated you, isn't it?
Very much so. And all the ways that these elaborate trading relationships between plants and fungi underlie so much of the life that we see around us, and so much of the biosphere hinges on this ability for fungi to feed plants with nutrients and plants to feed these fungi with energy compounds like sugars and fats. And so I think of this as just a fundamental union that anchors so much of what we understand.
Why do you think, Merlin Sheldrake, that this next piece by Tallis has an element of the mushroom to it?
It's such a powerful piece for me because you can hear these voices coming in one after the other, setting up a sort of sonic wave, which then is superseded by a subsequent sonic wave. And it's for me a little bit like I imagine the soil to be like, with chemical weather systems. As one set of organisms, say, starts to decompose, say, some wood, they finish what they're able to do, another microbial population comes in and picks up where they left off. And so it feels like listening to the chemical weather of a busy and healthy soil.
Is there something about the fact that we're listening to the human voice going through these elaborations that makes it particularly telling for you?
Yes, that these are voices powered by breath. The way that Tallis scores for the human voice feels to me extra powerful because it's grounded in the wild, wet world of a biological body. Mm. I think something about that pulls me into a profound place with him.
Is it really true that there are fungi in our breathing?
Yes, there are spores in the air. In fact, there are so many spores in the air, they influence the weather by precipitating droplets of water in the atmosphere. But we're breathing in spores all the time, most of which don't do us any harm. But we also have fungi on our body, lining our orifices and inside our body as well, which play very important roles.
Miserere Nostri by Thomas Tallis. We heard it performed by the Rudolphus Choir, conducted by Ralph Allwood. You conducted, Merlin Sheldrake, your doctoral research in the tropical forests of Panama, didn't you? What took you there?
I went there to work at a field station run by the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. And I lived most of the time on an island in the middle of the Panama Canal. Most of it's a big lake. Working on the relationships between the forest trees and the underground symbiotic fungi that trade nutrients with them. And surrounded by both bustling, astonishing tropical forest, and there's so many ways to be alive in a tropical forest, and I was always amazed at this, but also living alongside an astonishing diversity of scientists who had come there to study the diversity of the forest.
Well, talking of really various fungi, tell me a little bit more about the wood wide webs.
Fungi that connect with plant roots in trading relationships, we call these mycorrhizal fungi. They're very important. And each fungus is promiscuous. It can engage with more than one plant. And the plants are also promiscuous and can engage with more than one fungus. And the result is that you have shared overlapping networks of plants and fungi. And these shared networks can have interesting properties. I studied a plant in Panama that had lost the ability to photosynthesize. It was a bright blue flower on a...
Voiria.
A voiria, yeah, yes. On a slender white stalk, and it had just little scales where its leaves used to be. And it made its living, not by doing what most plants do, which is, you know, eating light and carbon dioxide, but by plugging into a shared mycorrhizal network and drawing from this network all the nutrients and energy that it needed to grow. So what it was doing essentially was drawing energy compounds from other plants through a fungal network, and it's just a fascinating way of life.
We're going to hear some music recorded in a forest, but actually not in Panama, but rather in southeast Cameroon.
Yes, recorded by someone called Louis Sano, and it's a recording of the Aka people, who are forest-dwelling people who live in very dense rainforest, surrounded by sound, and also communicate with each other through sound. In forests are very cluttered places. You can't see very far. There's a very close horizon. And so sound is a more effective way to communicate in these spaces than using visual signals. And so these people have evolved a most astonishing polyphonic music, both as a way to make music, but also as a way to communicate with each other and to know where each other are.
But this song that you've chosen is actually about gathering mushrooms, isn't it?
Well, it's called Women Gathering Mushrooms, and what it depicts is the sound of a group of women exploring the forest and gathering mushrooms. As they gather mushrooms, they're singing together within the song of the forest.
Most extraordinary.
One of the reasons why I think it's so amazing is that you can hear the human voices with the more than human voices all together in the place where the music's being sung. And I think about so much recording that we do, you've pulled it out of the noisy world to try and shield it from the noise of the world. But here you're hearing the music in situ, and really it makes sense there.
And there's a certain amount of freedom, I think, in the way they came in when they did.
Yeah, I don't know how exactly they coordinate their singing, but it feels like there's some point at which a critical mass happens and then they all come flooding in, and there's almost a leader, but you're not quite sure if they're a leader or whether they're taking it in turns. It's so intensely polyphonic.
We heard Women Gathering Mushrooms, sung by the women of the Barbengele tribe of the Central African Republic, recorded by Louis Sarno. Fungi have also played an important role in the culture and sacred rituals of other communities. In Central America, for example, mushroom stones or statues have been found, haven't they?
Yes, and these stones and statues are thought to refer to the what we would now call psychedelic mushrooms, which are known to have been taken by various peoples in this part of the world for a very long time. And now these mushrooms and the compounds they produce are finding fame today in a more scientific and medical context, as once again humans are realizing that these are compounds with the power to heal us from various problems. A fascinating finding suggesting that these psychedelic experiences can help people to overcome addiction, severe depression, severe anxiety that follows a terminal diagnosis, diseases of the mind and diseases of the soul, I might say.
Taking so-called magic mushrooms is, of course, illegal in the United Kingdom, but I know you took part in a controlled experiment where you took psilocybin, otherwise known as magic mushrooms, to think about some of the questions in this book. And what effect did they have on you?
Well, one of the effects was that I ended up laughing a lot. I had been warned about this in a preparatory risk assessment. But on the whole, my sense was that my mind was a much larger space and place than I had realised it was. I felt this sort of vast, roving expanse of mental and emotional possibility and could explore them. It was really exciting.
The next music, I think, could be related to the meditative state.
I think so. It's a piece that, for me, speaks to the oscillating, pulsing nature of reality. We have so many cycles repeating. We have our heartbeat on quite a short time scale, and we have our daily, our diurnal cycles. We have monthly cycles. We have annual seasonal cycles. And all of the rhythms of the planet, so the tides are cycles. And so these oscillating cycles and the way that they relate to other oscillating cycles and slip in and out of phase, it really is a fundamental part of existing, I think, in this place that we do. And I feel like this piece by Steve Reich somehow opens up that mystery and makes it audible.
Thank you.
It feels like how it might be like to be a cell in a society of cells in your body, or a termite in a termite mound, or a bee in a beehive. One sensing entity surrounded by many others, moving through phase worlds, and puts me into the most remarkable state of mind.
Pulses from the album Music for 18 Musicians by Steve Reich, performed by the ensemble Signal, conducted by Brad Lubman. Tell me a little bit more about the width of your love of music, because I know you're a real fan of jazz, aren't you?
Yeah, I started playing classical music on the piano, and then at school there was a fantastic jazz teacher who created a kind of culture of jazz, a large, irreverent figure who could play every jazz instrument apart from the trombone. But he would pick up a recorder and start playing Charlie Parker solos on it. And I inspired a real passion for improvisation and ensemble playing within the school, and made a very great impression on me and changed both my relationship with the music and I think also just the way that I think.
One of the things I find most wonderful about this program is how continuously a guest like you will talk about the inspiration that one particular teacher has had, how they opened the door to brave new worlds.
This is very much the case for me. And of course, once the door is open, then all other things flood in. And jazz has become a really powerful metaphor that has allowed me to make sense of so much. It feels somehow fundamental, the idea that one is improvising. And of course, we're improvising all the time. We're improvising now, but as we speak, we're improvising every day of our life and within constraints, you know. And I think actually on a large biological scale that all organisms are improvising, and improvising with, of course, because no organism lives in isolation. So jazz for me provides a metaphor to understand life itself, which sounds very grand, but the more I play jazz and hear jazz and the more I study biology, the more it makes sense.
I think you found it very hard to choose a jazz track, didn't you, because your love is so huge. What have you chosen?
It's a piece called My Funny Valentine, being played by Bill Evans, the pianist, and Jim Hall, the guitarist. Thank you.
My Funny Valentine, from the album Undercurrent by Bill Evans and Jim Hall, based on a Rodgers and Hart piece. What I thought was wonderful about that is the way it's so joyous. I find myself laughing at the way they throw ideas at each other and the way they then respond to that.
I do too. There's a kind of mirth which is infectious and a playfulness. And you can really hear the sound of them listening to each other, which for me is just wonderful. And so much is happening without the bass or the drums holding down the swing. So they're leaving a lot of space. It's almost like you have the bass and the drums being sounded by the negative space that's left for them to exist within. So there's a lot implied. And that sense of trust that one will continue to imply what needs to be implied as the other is taking off on some wild journey of the imagination.
Turning to the film that you've made with Björk, which I mentioned earlier, called Fungi, The Web of Life, how did that collaboration come about?
A production team in Australia wanted to make an IMAX film about fungi. So I joined them as presenter and spent a lot of amazing time walking around in Tasmanian forests, which are ancient fragments. It's like walking around in a forest that a dinosaur might have explored.
But it wasn't a dinosaur you met, it was Björk.
it was Björk, who came onto the project later as the narrator and brings so much magic to the film. You know, lots of the film is time-lapse sequences of fungi doing their thing, and she's an ideal guide, I think, to their mysteries.
You, Merlin Sheldrake, often harness the powers of fungi and mushrooms in brewing, don't you?
I do love to brew, yeah, and I make hot sauce with my brother Cosmo. We ferment all sorts of things, whether it be kimchi or sauerkraut or pickles or beers or ciders or elderflower champagnes, Rhone wines and Hawthorn wines. And I love the process of fermenting because you're never really in control. You can narrow the possibility space for these communities of yeasts, but you can never really totally direct them. So you're always kind of luring them forwards. And through this process, you taste the outcome of waves of microbial populations transforming matter, as we talked about earlier, from one form into another. But in this case, you can taste the transformations with your own unaided senses.
Great plus to your scientific work, to aid your relaxation. But you have, Merlin, warned about the catastrophic effect fungi can have when they get out of hand.
Well, fungi are a kingdom of life, which is a broad category. And there are lots of ways to be a fungus. And some fungi cause problems for us, whether in the form of diseases, as human diseases, or as diseases of plants that we depend on. These problem-causing fungi represent only a tiny fraction of fungal diversity overall, but it's an important fraction from our point of view. And fungi is a neglected kingdom of life, you know, a kingdom of life that's not had a kingdom's worth of attention. Also within the realm of medical mycology, fungi are understudied. So there's not a single vaccine that's been developed against a fungal disease. The research budgets for fungal diseases of humans is tiny compared with the research budgets for bacterial and viral diseases. So it's an area we could do well to pay more attention.
But on the positive, there are hopeful ways in which they're being used. Decomposing plastics, for example, radioactive waste.
Yes, fungi have powerful appetites and chemical abilities we could only dream of. So some fungi are able to break down certain types of plastic. Some are able to sequester heavy metals and could help in environmental cleanup operations. Fungi produce all sorts of drugs that we depend on and which have transformed modern life. Penicillin is a very famous case. And fungi can build new materials. There's a field of mycofabrication where people are building textile-like materials from fungi. Or rather, fungi are building the materials themselves. They weave themselves into these materials and humans can then use them.
I think you even turned your book when it was finished into fungi.
Well, I invited an oyster mushroom fungus, Pleurotus, to digest a copy of the book. You know, I'd spent so much time in a darkened room in front of a computer screen. I felt very separated from the biological cycles that I'd been writing about. So I thought, what better way to close the loop than to feed a copy of the book to the fungus and then eat the mushrooms that the fungus produced so I could eat my words.
I'm sure it enjoyed your book as much as I did, even if in a different way. Only it remains for me to thank you and to choose your final track.
Final track is Music for a While by Purcell. It's a lament. It's a very melancholy track and talks about the power of music to affect us. And it falls within the larger work as a kind of spell, as a kind of way to calm and to tranquilize a monstrous being. And if all of the music in the world were to be vaporized in a single instant, this might be one of the first pieces of music to spring back into being, a musical lament for all the music that had been lost. And this is just how it strikes me, you know, it seems to me so haunting.
Thank you very much for a most fascinating, riveting conversation, Merlin.
Thank you for having me.
Music for a While by Henry Purcell, performed by the countertenor Alfred Deller, with William Christie on the harpsichord and Wieland Kirchen on the bass viol. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the biologist and fungi expert Merlin Sheldrake. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael will be talking to the forensic soil scientist Lorna Dawson. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker. It's 1 o'clock and time for the news read by me, Jane Royce. The Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron, has refused to rule out the possibility of more airstrikes against the Houthis in Yemen. He's defended the action, which was carried out with the US, saying it was essential to protect global trade and that the attacks were a last resort. The Houthis have been launching strikes on cargo ships in the Red Sea. The Labour leader Keir Starmer has reiterated his support, saying doing nothing was not an appropriate way to respond, but that any further measures should be considered on their merits. Israeli businesses have held a 100-minute strike to mark 100 days since the war with Hamas began. The head of the country's main labour union said Israel was in a terrible dream. Hundreds of hostages who were taken from the country by Hamas during the 7th of October attacks remain in Gaza. The Hamas-run health ministry in the territory says almost 24,000 Palestinians have been killed in the conflict. 5 migrants have died after their boat sank in the Channel. Another person remains in a critical condition in hospital. Around 70 people were attempting to travel to the UK when their vessel got into trouble shortly after leaving France. A specialist care centre has been set up to look after those who were on board. China has strongly criticised the United States for congratulating Taiwan's president-elect William Lai, saying it sent the wrong message to those pushing for the island's independence. Beijing says the statement by the US Secretary of State violates Washington's commitment to maintain only unofficial ties with Taiwan. Mr. Lai has vowed to protect Taiwan from Chinese intimidation and maintain the island's democracy. A volcano has erupted in southwestern Iceland, close to where a similar eruption occurred last month. People who were evacuated from a nearby fishing town because of the previous eruption have once more been told to leave. Denmark's Queen Margrethe is due to abdicate from the throne about now, ending her 52-year reign. She will sign a declaration in the Danish Parliament. Her eldest son, Frederick, and his wife, Mary, will become the new King and Queen of Denmark. And the weather bright with variable cloud for most, with the odd shower possible along coasts. Windier with more rain in northern Scotland and some sleet and snow. And tonight will be dry, clear and cold for most. BBC News, it's 2 minutes past one.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music. Join us this week for some unique performances that you won't get anywhere else, including the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and Stravinsky's Pulcinella.
Michael Gertz conducting the Ulster Orchestra in Belfast.
The BBC Symphony Orchestra playing Schumann at the Barbican in London.
And the Scottish Chamber Orchestra marking its 50th anniversary live from Glasgow's City Halls.